My name is Les James. It's April 9th, and I am about ready to interview Kathy Magnuson, who works at Highliner Travel in Kodiak.
Training in Arkansas. She went to the University of Central Arkansas. She took some classes at Anchorage, went to Minnesota and a class in a college in Oregon. For a while, she wasn't sure what she was going to do, and so she...
I have a child like that.
Yeah. Finally, she found out, because the University of Alaska Anchorage didn't have a special ed program, she had to go out of state, and mm-hmm. she had a cousin in Arkansas, so she went to Central Arkansas and got her degree. And
there's usually a reason for why people end up where they do.
Right.
And so.
Me, on the other hand, I was born and raised in California, and graduated from college in 85 with a teaching degree.
In California, where it was economical.
Yeah. And I taught 8 years and decided I'd had enough. The state's getting kind of crowded. And so I came up, for the first time, I came up to photograph brown bears at McNeil River in 93.
Not as a job, just
to... Not as a job. I just always wanted to come to Alaska. So I came up, photographed brown bears, and then decided that I really liked Alaska and I wanted to come back and look for a teaching job the next year. And so I came at the April job fair in Anchorage, and that's where Mary and I met last April in Anchorage. One thing led to another, and I came back up in June for the next job fair, and then in fact, that was the first time we interviewed with Kodiak. And then she came down and met my family in July, spent some time down there, and then came back. And then the last job fair was in August, and we still, neither of us had jobs. She had some offers, but it meant that she would go to Bethel or a rural district, and there wouldn't be a job for me. And so mm-hmm. we held out, and we said, well, we need to get jobs in the same district, maybe not the same school, but at least in the same mm-hmm. district. And so about 3 days before, I was still teaching in California at a sixth grade position, and about 3 days before I was supposed to meet with my staff, our staff at Miss Fargo Middle School, Kodiak called, and I was up at my parents at the time, and was kind of bummed out that I'd spent all that time, the whole summer, and back and forth trying to get a job. Marcia Oswalt calls and asks if I can do a phone interview, because they were offering Mary the special ed position, and Mary said she would take it if there was also a job for me. And so Marcia Oswalt called and said, well, can you do a phone interview with the other two principals of the elementary schools and another, I don't know if it was Betty Walters or someone mm-hmm. from the central office. I said, sure, why not? I've interviewed all summer. Here's another one over the phone. I said, fine. She said, well, can you be ready in about 45 minutes? I said, yeah. And so I interviewed and talked with all the principals from the elementary schools, and it was probably a half hour, 45 minute interview. And then within a couple of hours, they called back and said, well, we're pretty interested. We have a few things to look at as far as paperwork, and we're trying to contact one more of your references. And I said, okay, all right. So they called back the next day and ended up offering me the position if I wanted it. When can you be here was the question. That was on a Sunday. It was the last day of the county fair in Susanville. That was on Sunday. And I said, well, I can be there Friday. I said, I can be there Friday afternoon. I'll miss the work day that's scheduled for the district. And, oh, it was a nightmare. I had to put my house up for sale, scrambled around. It was just something else getting ready and getting into it. And so we didn't have a place to live. We came to Kodiak, lived with Marcia Oswalt for the first week, found a place the next Friday when we were flying out. The day we were flying out to go to Anchorage to get married, it all just happened like that.
It was
pretty stressful. Anyways.
But you survived it.
We survived it. I think things are working out great. Sometimes you meet that person that you just know.
It doesn't take that long.
Yeah, it was incredible. I came out looking for a job and my whole life changed.
See, there's a reason for what you're doing.
Right.
Where you are.
So I'm real happy to be here, and this is one requirement that I have to satisfy for my teaching credentials. So.
Mm. Well, it's not a bad one.
Oh, no. No, not at all. I guess we can talk about any topic that you'd like to. I'm kind of interested in what it was like during the earthquake. I think Mary said that you were in high school.
I was.
During the earthquake?
Yeah. I was a junior in high school. I just had my 17th birthday, and, you know, you don't have any cares or any thoughts about anything
except
yourself, you know, and what you're going to do. And in fact, I was on the phone when the earthquake hit. And I was at home alone, and we lived out on the base. And my folks had a cabin out of Chinook. And as they off almost every weekend, they went out to the cabin. And my mother had left Thursday after school and taken all the kids, except myself and my sister. And I worked at the Navy Exchange, and so that was my excuse. I didn't want to go. As a teenager, I'd had enough of that family stuff. And my dad left that Friday right after work, so he'd been gone about an hour. With my sister when the earthquake hit. And I was talking on the phone, arranging. One of my friends was going to come to town to something that was going on at the high school. And I was going to ride with him. And we talked through the first part of the earthquake. And it, you know, because they come and they go, and you just don't pay that much attention.
Right.
In California,
you've
been through them.
Yeah.
But this no, one.
Nothing that big, though.
No. We finally decided, I said, Jerry, I need to get off the phone. We need to get some cover.
So you were on the phone when it was shaking, when the ground was actually shaking and the building was...
There was enough time that we concluded that we needed to get off the phone because this was bad, because things were starting to fall out of the cupboards. And I got off the phone, and it was difficult to walk from the living room to the door. And you know to stand in a doorway, and then you see the doorway to the kitchen was where I was standing, and things were falling out of cupboards on both sides, and you could see things heaving.
Yeah.
And you know, you've been in earthquakes before, and things kind of shudder,
right.
But they don't roll, and you can't see that wave of movement.
Yeah.
And you know, I began to get a little concerned, and so I got through the kitchen to the back door, which was kind of dodging things, and got outside. I don't know why. And the ground was just, you know, it was really difficult to stand up in because you had nothing to hang on to.
Mm.
And, you know, you could see the cars bouncing up and down. And I heard a power line stretch and snap, and I thought, this is not the brightest thing I've ever done. And I had time to walk back into the doorway again, into the porch, before it quit.
So you stayed in the door frame?
Yeah.
Yeah.
After that.
Well, that's to me, I guess, since the epicenter was close to Anchorage, right? Wasn't it?
Mm-hmm. South of Anchorage.
It's amazing that Kodiak would feel it. But I guess it rolls through the floor of the ocean and just takes everything. And
And you just, it's the luck of the draw, I swear, of you know, which way it affects, because we've been close to earthquakes before that didn't cause that kind of movement or action.
Right.
So it was.
Who were you on the phone with again?
A friend of mine, a guy named Jerry, who was in the same class that I was. He played basketball.
Was he in Kodiak?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
His family lived on the base too. He lived across. Right by the runway out on the base. And you know, all of that is just flat.
Right.
And his parents managed the Marine Club, I think it was. And so, and they lived up above, and that was on a hill, and that was the only high spot between the ocean. It was the ocean and that hill. It's where, very near to where Peterson was temporarily last year.
If you've seen
that.
Yeah, it's up by the Golden Acre.
Yeah, okay. It, where the Marine Club was just a little bit higher than the Golden Acre. And
is that out of the tsunami range?
No.
No.
But nobody knew at that point. Tsunami was not a word that anybody knew, or that certainly
right.
that I knew. And
probably didn't have drills or.
Well, you know, my dad. We had lived on the base or been associated with the base for years and years, and my dad had been a block warden. And so we'd grown up with drills,
mm-hmm.
and his job had always been to, it was always associated with war, that we had these, you know, they were these drills,
right.
and his job was always to go to a certain area and make sure that those people got out, and then somebody was assigned to our area and made sure that we got out, and we had things we were supposed to do and places we were supposed to go that we were pre-assigned to. So we all knew basically that, you know, you needed to move
mm-hmm.
in some situations, but nothing, you know, this wasn't something really that we prepared for.
Right.
Nobody had.
Yeah.
And I, even after it was over, I remember feeling relieved, and then it would shudder again, you know, and you would go
aftershocks.
You know, you would wonder how bad it was going to be. But it was real different.
And the earthquakes that I've been in California were just like you say, just kind of shakers, and you just kind of okay, I'm in an earthquake, no big deal, look, it's over.
Yeah.
And you know, something hanging might be swaying back and forth or something, but it wasn't that magnitude, anything of that magnitude.
Yeah.
I wasn't close to the one in 89 that shook San Francisco and Santa Cruz. I remember the one in 71, Los
mm-hmm.
Angeles earthquake in 71. We lived in Tehachapi, probably, you know, 2 or 3 hours away, and I remember my brother's bed shaking across the wood floor and sliding across the floor
mm-hmm.
and then stopping across the other side of the room. And I woke up, and we all ran into my parents' room.
Mm-hmm.
We woke him up. Of course, he had missed it, so he was mad. But when I think of Kodiak, of course, after what I've heard about the tidal wave, then it's the initial surviving the earthquake, and then you know that there's a potential for a wave coming.
But,
I guess.
Yeah, and I don't think that... it took a while for me. Well, I was by myself, and I remember trying to clean up.
You just started cleaning things up?
Yeah, I remember trying to pick stuff up and clean things up. I mean, when my parents came home, I traditionally had the house all clean, and,
uh-huh.
and you know, that was just my job. That was my little payback for getting the weekend to myself. And that was okay with me, so I started picking things up, and then... I don't remember whether we had phones. I don't think we had electricity or water or anything, but I don't remember for sure. And this lady that I was very close to lived two doors down from me, and I must have gone over to her house after I picked some things up. And she was frantic. Her husband was the fire chief. And she was like my other mother. She was just real special to me. And she had a son who was a year younger than I was, and we were very close, my brother and sister. She was panicked because he wasn't at home, and he had gone over to the exchange,
mm-hmm.
Or to the movie or something. And she was just hysterical. And I'd never seen her like that. She was always the calming person in my life. So it was a little... disconcerting, you know, to see her like that, and I'm wondering, you know, what do you do, because I can't call anyone, I can't do anything. I remember feeling helpless that I couldn't do anything for her, and
right.
she couldn't calm down. I don't remember how she ever found out that he was okay. There are lots of things that I just don't remember.
Right, and probably some things you tend to want to block out and haven't thought about.
Probably, yeah.
Did the wave come close to where you lived when the wave tidal wave hit, or were you far enough away where?
I didn't stay there. We did get word. I don't remember how it happened. Somehow my brother showed up. I had an older brother who had graduated from high school the year before and who worked on the base, and he came to the house as soon as he could to check on me. And somehow we knew that we had to move by that time, that we needed to go higher. And so we all went up to the, up on what was then Aviation Hill. Now I don't know what it is. But it's this side of the school. It's mm-hmm. that last hill you go down before you get into school.
Yeah, I know that is.
And we all spent the night up there and really didn't know what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
We heard that there were, you know, that there were waves, and you heard rumors, and you heard a lot of hysteria, but, there, you know, it was more like a party at that point.
Right.
For people my age. Right. I mean, all of us were together, and we were just goofing off.
Mm-hmm. So you don't know when the wave actually hit?
No.
Yeah.
Not anything that I saw.
Mm-hmm. When did you find out the wave? Do you remember?
After when it got light.
So it was at night when it hit.
Mm-hmm.
The earthquake hit.
People say that they could see it come and go here in town. And I'm, you know, it was, what time was it? 5:30 when it happened? And it was only March, so, you know, it's not that light for that long. But I don't know what time it hit.
Yeah.
Of my own knowledge, I don't know.
Yeah, I could probably find out.
I know that from my mother's notes, you know, I could tell, because my brother was killed in the tidal wave, mm-hmm. and he had been with my mother, and she put it all down in a journal just as a way of dealing with it herself,
sure.
You know, but we really had no clue of what was going on in where we were.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that as the word came out, I went to a friend's house after that, because my brother went to do whatever brothers do. And her father was the captain in charge of the air station. And I stayed at their house. They had a fireplace, and so we could be warm.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a whole bunch of us, and again, it was still like a big party, but you began to sense that something bad had happened, and that people really didn't want to talk about it, and then they just tried to keep us busy the
right.
next day. So they sent us to get firewood from a place where, you know, the prisoners used to have to chop firewood for the officers, and it was all kept in a building.
Oh, really?
And the guys in the brig, whatever mm-hmm. I don't know who, that's all we knew. And we went to that building and got firewood, and everyone else was there getting firewood, and that was the first time that I heard that the tidal wave had wiped out Calson Bay and everyone in it. Mm-hmm. And that was where my family was supposed to have been, and so I was in my, and no one was telling me that, I guess I was just hearing it.
Mm-hmm.
So I began to get really concerned at that point.
Well,
but still didn't know anything really.
Yeah. Your family went there to visit at Calson Bay, or what?
They had a cabin.
Mm.
You know, there was so much military here during World War II, and there was a big military installation all the way out at the end of the road at Chiniac.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you've driven out there.
I've seen some of the pillboxes.
And the Quonset huts and all of that. And
yeah.
From time to time, the Navy, in its infinite wisdom, would say, okay, if you guys want to fix one of those up and use it for a weekend retreat, you can do that. And then pretty soon they'd get mad and they'd say, no, you can't go out there anymore. And so everybody'd have to stop going out there. But anyway, we had mostly, and all the time I was growing up, we spent summers out there and weekends out there. And people fixed up those pillboxes and they fixed up the Quonsets.
Yeah.
But at the time, my parents had I think they were staying in a cabin right in Calson Bay.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't remember for sure.
Mm. Wow, that must have been.
But that, that it didn't, you know, the place was gone.
Yeah.
And
well, there's not much there now. If you drive by, you have a little mm-hmm. bar and restaurant there and a couple of trailers.
And there really wasn't much there then. That bar that's there now was built afterward. There was a house there. It was kind of there was a ranch there. And there was an old house there. And then there were two concrete, you'll still see the concrete frames across the road.
Yeah, Gary talked about that. It was like a big barn or something.
Well, there was a big barn there. But across the road where the two little concrete foundations are that are by that little lake that somebody's made,
okay,
right underneath the cliff, that's where the two cabins were that these people, one of the two couples that lived there were quite elderly and they were like grandparents to us.
Mm-hmm.
And the other couple that lived there were just people we'd known since we were real small.
Right.
And my family spent a lot of time with them, and they were with my mother at the time
mm-hmm.
that the tidal wave came. So, and then there was a house across the street and a barn. I can't remember what all was there.
Yeah.
But it certainly changed the landscape.
Yeah.
You know, it just really changed.
You look at some of those pictures around the Anchorage, and incredible houses on their sides and the big gully.
Yeah. They lost so much. I don't think we had the destruction of homes that they did, you know, at all. We didn't have that kind of major storm.
Or some landslides, I'd imagine, up down on the cliffs, probably.
Mm-hmm. And where there were places on the road to Chiniac. I remember the first time I went out there afterward, there was a you could see fault lines.
Oh, really?
And across the road, out there on before you got to Calson Bay,
mm-hmm.
up there where the road is so high,
mm-hmm.
there was one place where you couldn't get through at the very first because the road had shifted and this road, you know, there was quite a distance, a variation in the levels of the road. And it was there were no bridges. The bridges were all. So you couldn't
because of the water. I guess the water.
Yeah.
Well, and shaking too. I guess we'll take.
Yeah. I don't know what really took it when there were some of the bridges were moved and you could see them up farther.
Hmm.
The bridge was concrete and you could see. I think it was concrete. You could see the entire bridge just moved up the river. You know, and then in other cases there was nothing left, and not all of them were gone, but enough that you couldn't get.
You were attending high school in town at the time?
Okay. That's always been the only high school.
I had heard that they turned the high school into a shelter.
Did
people go there with bunks? And
they did.
Okay.
That was one of the busy jobs that Cindy's dad gave to us was, why don't you guys go to town and see if you can help out in town? So one day we did that. And they were feeding people at the high school, and
I guess they would have showers in the gym, and they would have.
I think that everything was working.
Yeah.
I think so, but not having to use it, you know, we just kind of camped out. Some people, I think, had facilities that we could use on the base, and some didn't. But
yeah.
By that time, there were the Red Cross had set up at the armory,
mm-hmm.
by the school, and there were boxes and boxes and boxes of stuff coming in.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing the things, you wonder where they got some of the stuff.
Yeah.
It's just, some of it was pretty dramatic. You know, it looked like it had been around for years.
Probably
years.
Army surplus or
well,
something. Food items?
There were food items, I believe, but then the thing that they had us sorting was clothes.
Oh. So yeah. Probably donated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it looked like it would have been more costume material. It had been and some of it was real old.
Hmm.
But maybe it was just what we happened to hit on.
So did they cancel school for a while? Were you out of school?
Mm-hmm.
Month or?
No. Gosh, I don't know how long school was at. Since that was Good Friday and then we had Easter, I don't think we missed that much school, maybe a week.
So you were able to go back into your old classrooms?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, so they were mm-hmm. okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Hmm. Yeah. I don't, here in town, other than the boats and the boat harbor being a mess, you didn't see much damage. And really the houses on the base weren't. You know, we all went back and lived in our houses once they got the power plant unflooded
mm-hmm.
and, you know, working again.
Wow.
Hmm. But it was quite a chore for everybody to get everything cleaned up, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm. I've heard that the Lions Club helped move or relocate the village that was on Fognac.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what's Port Lyons now?
Right.
Okay.
Right. If you have the occasion to go out in a boat, you can see where their old village was.
Oh, really?
And we stopped by there summer before last, and some of the houses are still quite nice. I mean, but they just didn't feel like it was a place to live anymore.
Yeah.
So it was really low and really not safe, and some of them had been pretty damaged.
Yeah. So
yeah.
Okay. So when did you first come to Kodiak?
I came when I believe I was almost six, and I came on a boat. My dad had taken a job after the war, after he got out of the Air Force. He had taken a job in civil service, and they would transport, you would sign a contract for 2 years or a year or whatever, and they would send you and your entire family to Alaska,
mm-hmm.
and that's what they did. But I had been sick, and so I had stayed behind, and so they came down and got me after that time. And,
where were you living before you came?
In Washington State.
Washington, okay.
So it wasn't that far, you know, that far from put us on a ship in Seattle and send us all up.
Wow.
But we quickly discovered that sea travel was not. I was sick. I remember being sick the whole time. I saw pictures later of that someone had taken out a window out of one of the portholes. I thought, that's the way I saw it.
Yeah, right.
The only time I remember going upstairs was for, at the very beginning when they made you put on your Mae West and go out there for safety drills, you know.
Hmm.
And that's the only time.
That was the survival suit? Or
that was the life jacket.
Okay.
You know,
okay.
And they didn't have kid size. I remember that they were just huge. You had all these straps dangling all over the place, and it was just very much fun.
So you remember that trip at six years old, coming and being
all sick. I remember being with my brother and being sick, and I remember being outside on that ship. But not much more than that.
Was it a military ship, or?
It was part of the military transport service. It was had been a troop ship.
Okay.
You know, that's. There were lots of us that they were moving around.
Hmm.
And I think that's probably how they sent people to Guam and, the civilian people,
right,
when they were sent to the bases.
So when you arrived here, your father was working on the Navy base.
Mm-hmm.
And what did he do?
He was he ran the road grader. When we first got here, we lived out at Bell's Flats, which in one of those Quonset huts.
Okay.
And he ran, his job was to keep the runways clean.
Okay.
At first, and then to clean the roads. And we thought that was pretty neat, because every winter we had the best snow forts of anybody, because the grader somehow managed to build us some pretty nice walls.
All right.
It's one of the perks.
Did they have the dairy out there at that time, at Bell's Flats?
There was a dairy here then. And I'm trying to remember if we got, if the Navy bought milk from them or not. I don't know.
I think that's how it got its name. There was a guy named Bill.
Right, it was his, yeah.
Who had a dairy, and I'm just wondering if you remember anything about
that. I don't. I remember that the radio station used to be out in Bell's Falls.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Across the river.
Up on a hill? It must have been up.
I don't think it was up on a hill.
Seems kind of...
Well, you know, the military, what did they call the radio system that they had? The Armed Forces Radio?
Mm-hmm.
That's what it... And it was just in its beginning, if I remember right, and our radio station was out on the base. I have no idea why it would have been out there, except that there, you know, that was a place full of barracks from World War II, and maybe that's where it had originally been, and it just stayed there.
Yeah.
Okay. But there were barracks all over the place, you know, just everywhere.
So you graduated from Kodiak,
and then got married a year later.
Really?
Yeah. Wow. Worked on the base for a year and then got married. Yeah. Never went away to school.
Were you here in the, switching gears here a little bit, were you here during the, was it the 70s where they had the height of the crab fishing in Kodiak? I've read a little bit of Spike Walker's book, Danger on the High Seas, and read about the crabbing industry as being one of the most dangerous jobs that you could have here. And in the book, he writes about his experiences trying to find a job on a crab boat and going to the different bars and meeting people who had boats, and so he kind of has that color of the community. I haven't finished the book, but what's your perception of Kodiak during the crab fishing days? Was it a lot different than it is now, or is it?
I think it was a lot different in some ways. It was not. It was pretty wild. There were a lot of people without any ties. There were a lot of young people making a lot of money in the 70s who had come from Minnesota and, you know, Oregon, all over the place, and they were making more money than they knew what to do with. I was working as a bookkeeper. For 7 years I worked for one of the local bookkeepers, and we did fishery settlements. These guys would come to town, and the skippers would bring us a check, and there's a beer box full of receipts, and we'd figure out, you know, who got how much based on the percentages that they told us. And during those days, it was nothing at all for me to be writing checks. I know there were days when I wrote over $1 million worth of checks in a day. And you know, because they'd bring you their settlement from the cannery, and you'd send some to Uncle Sam, you know, disperse it to the crews and pay bills and give the rest back to them. And it was just, it was amazing.
Wow.
It was a lot of money. A lot of money.
I'm kind of amazed that as I drive around town, looking at some of the homes that are here, that there seem to be, at least by the waterfront, a lot of small little homes that were probably, I'm guessing, cannery workers or someone that was tied to the industry. And then as you drive around, you see these huge, some huge homes that are almost hotel-sized, tri-level homes. And of course, my wife and I have been looking for a house here in Kodiak, and there aren't many homes within our price range. And I'm just wondering if most of those homes, was there a big building boom during the crab fishing time?
A lot of people came here and settled here. You know, when I was growing up, people came here to fish salmon in the summer Mm-hmm. And the people here who fished salmon in the summer, and that's all they did, you know. And so it was a sleepy, quiet town. It was real busy in the summertime, and then very quiet the rest of the year. And then this crabbing started about the time, well, it was the mid-60s.
Mm-hmm.
And it brought in a lot of people who had, you know, who had no ties, and then they began to eventually marry and settle down and build houses here.
Sure.
But most of the small houses that you see are very old.
Mm-hmm.
And if you were to look at the lots up in the borough office,
mm-hmm.
they're not sitting where they belong. Their lot sizes are not right. You know, most of them are, a lot of them are, don't meet the guidelines for building. They were just built before all the rules started.
Wow.
You know, a lot of the houses right here in the city.
Mm-hmm.
So
I look at some of the homes, and they look like they would have been around during the earthquake and tidal wave, and I'm wondering, a lot of them are fairly close to the water, and so I try to picture how high the water was and where the wave hit, because some of those homes look like they've been there for maybe
You're
before
right.
the tidal wave.
There are homes that are down on the ones that intrigue me most are the ones that are down in the channel.
Yeah.
They weren't taken.
Yeah.
You know, they're just there.
It's interesting.
The KEA plant was covered with water and,
mm-hmm.
and was flooded, I guess, to a certain level. I don't know what level, but
mm-hmm.
And there was water in town here up to the Orpheum.
Wow.
But that didn't seem to be the kind that did damage. It kind of, it looked like it raised, you know, calmly.
Yeah.
So I don't know.
Yeah. I was just.
It's just amazing.
It seemed like there's a big, there is a big gap in the building industry,
mm-hmm.
In my mind, you know, with those huge homes and then those older, smaller homes. And now there are some homes being built that are kind of mid-size.
We've had a problem in Kodiak with availability of land for building,
mm-hmm.
too. You know, there hasn't been that much, and then it got very expensive because there was so little.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then building was difficult.
Sure.
So, you're right, there is a big gap.
So
I never thought about it because I wasn't looking for a house.
Right.
But there was a lot of houses built in the 70s.
I was wondering if most of those people made money in the crabbing industry and decided to stay here, and they took that money and built homes, or were they built, the bigger homes, were they built by people coming to retire here in Kodiak, or?
No, my perception of that would be the people who were making a lot of money and just building new houses. Yeah, there were not any, nobody came here with a lot of money to retire.
Mm-hmm. So that crabbing industry lasted through the 70s and then kind of died off?
Here, yeah. I was trying to remember when the first crab festival was. There's always been a spring festival.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm thinking maybe it was more 4th of July when I was little that we had. And then the crab festival, what I was getting to was that the crab festival has kind of been a joke because there isn't any crab, you know,
right
here. And I don't know how long that's been, but since they closed the crab season, it's been at least 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it just died, and people just moved westward, you know, to fish.
Yeah.
Farther away. But there's been other things in between. At the same time they were fishing crab, it seems like at the same time I was doing crab settlements, there were huge halibut landings.
Hmm.
And a lot of that fishery was outside fishermen.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they didn't live here, they came here only to fish. There were a lot of them Canadians.
Wow.
And they had to pay a tax. And so they came in and settled up and paid their tax, and then they left.
Hmm.
And then there were there was a lot of money in shrimp, but that was a very short-lived fishery.
Yeah, I haven't heard much about the shrimp industry. Must have.
And then there were scallop. The scallopers came, and they were able to make a good living for a number of years. It was never anything that there were that many boats involved in, but at one time I would bet that there were between 5 and 10 of the East Coast scallopers who'd given up over there and come here. And the money.
How do you think the IFQs are going to affect the fishing? Or what little I've read is, I think it's the IFQ program was an attempt to, and maybe it's the propaganda that you hear, but it was an attempt to save lives. There's so many people lost at sea trying to make a living because the season is so short, and so they have to go out in rough weather. And from what I've heard about the IFQs, they're trying to cut down on that, because if you have a quota, you can go out in nice weather at any time and then just stop fishing once you've met that quota. But I've heard a lot of negative towards it too.
I think that's a wonderful idea, and that as I travel and you talk, people, when they hear you're from Alaska, they want to talk about different things, and they talk about seafood, and they're always trying to feed you farm-fed, farm-grown, artificially whatever fish, or they're trying to get you to eat that crab that isn't crab, and I'm pretty picky, and we get into discussions, and one of the things I've always heard is that people don't buy Alaska's seafood as much as they would, because it's only available at a certain time of year.
Mm-hmm.
And so I do understand the logic to that reasoning, but at the same time, the way that it was determined to be done is really bad.
Mm-hmm.
And it really smacks of the guys who are in power are the guys with money, and they're making decisions for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really, that's how it comes down to us, and it's bad. I don't think it's going to be good.
Seems like the people who've been involved in fishing, was it 6 years or 7 years ago, then you were eligible for IFQs? I don't remember, but those long-term fishermen got the lion's share of the IFQs. So that's the flip side, is you're making them even more wealthier because they don't need that many IFQs, so they're selling their extra shares to fishermen who may or may not be able to afford them, who probably are barely making payments on their boats. And
well,
I can see where it's going to eliminate a lot of fishermen.
It is, and the sad thing is that what you have in Alaska, or in Kodiak anyway, and I don't really have any first-hand knowledge of anywhere else, is you have a lot of owners in Kodiak who don't work their own boats. You have a lot of guys who have made them rich by working their boats for them. And those guys who work those boats during those years don't get anything. And that's the sad part.
Yeah.
That's the part that makes it so bad.
Right.
There are people like my husband who wants to fish locally on a very small scale for halibut, and built a boat for that reason, and then all of this came out and he can't.
Mm.
But that's not as sad as, and you say America, you should be, that's a product that's out there, it belongs to all of us, why can't we have it? But it's really sad for these guys who worked all these years for these fishermen, and now those guys who own those boats are getting there.
Yeah. They get the IFQs and they can sell the extra shares that they're not going to use. And then, like you say, the people who work their boats don't get anything. That doesn't seem too fair.
No. And there are a lot of guys around, who fit into that, that category. A lot of guys who fished on deck. Maybe they didn't run a boat, but they fished on deck during those tough years, and they made the money finally, and now they can't
Right.
They can't do anything. And it's people my age, that's, you know, some of them, and young.
People with families
have to
probably sell everything if they can't afford to buy the IFQs or aren't eligible, then that just eliminates them. But yet they have a boat or several boats that they're going to have to sell.
And they probably have gear. I mean, all of that stuff costs money. And they've probably been in that fishery perhaps and not long enough, and so they've got a little bit of gear too. So I just feel really bad for them.
Yeah.
And it's one more way that we had it good. I mean, we could have, a lot of the guys who are getting all those IFQs are my age and older, and some of them are my age, but a lot of them are younger, who can't benefit. And so it's one more way that our younger generation is being
eliminated.
The American dream is just going down the toilet for them.
Just wonder how that might be overturned, because it seems like there's growing opposition. I've seen some things on the news, Anchorage, they're having some protests, and I just noticed the signs around Kodiak.
Did you see the parade yesterday?
No.
It was on TV last night. I was flipping through the channels late last night, and there were a lot of boats
really?
Who paraded up and down the channel yesterday protesting, and a lot of the businesses closed from 12 to 1 in support of that. And I was amazed. I thought they got it together really quickly and did a good job.
Yeah, it seems like there's growing awareness of what IFQs really mean.
There have been some voices from the very beginning who said, you know, this is not good, and this is, and you go, well, is he just off on a, you know, is this doomsday? What's really going on here? And it takes some time, and hopefully things don't pass before everybody figures out what's going on. And I think they figured it out.
I just wonder if that can be overturned by the legislature, or if Tony Knowles could get involved with that, or I guess I don't know that much about, I'm still learning about